Good day. Today is Saturday, 18th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, over the last 24 hours, there's been some sense of some sort of rumblings in Kiev, hinting, if not exactly to a coup, or at least a coup attempt, to something which perhaps might bear some resemblance to it. Now, I say all of that, I'm not suggesting that President Zelensky or his government are under any serious pressure or are likely to fall, but it does seem to me, based on what I've been hearing, that there was at least an attempt made over the last 2 days following the fall of the defense minister, Mikhailo Fyodorov, to launch some kind of appeal to some sections of the armed forces, the Ukrainian armed forces, who might be considered to be unhappy with President Zelensky and with Ukraine's military chief, General Sirsky, in order to put pressure on these two individuals and perhaps first and foremost to secure Sirsky's dismissal. Now, there have been all sorts of very strange things going on, and well, the first of these hints came from a source which I would consider far from reliable in this context, and that is the Russian newspaper Radovka. Now, bear in mind, this is a Russian newspaper, but it said that yesterday and in the days, in the hours after Fyodorov's resignation, which was really a dismissal, and directly following a news conference and press conference that Fyodorov gave, there have been various attempts to try to win over various military officers to get them to resign from the military in solidarity with Fyodorov and to get them to take a stand, a public stand, against Sirsky and ultimately against the political and military leadership headed by Zelensky. And according to Radovka, and you have to take all of this with a massive mountain of salt, because to repeat again, this is a Russian newspaper, the key individual that the plotters, if you can call them that, were trying to win over was the Ukrainian army commander, General Drapaty, who is widely known to be strongly supported by the pro-Western NGO type of person in Kiev, who have been protesting over the last few days on Fyodorov's behalf. And from what I can understand, it does seem as if Drapaty has indeed made some public statements recently, perhaps over the last couple of hours, which could be construed as critical of Sirsky and perhaps even supportive of Fyodorov, though I should stress I've not been able to find them myself, so that makes it hard to judge. But anyway, there's no word that he's resigned or come out publicly against Sirsky and Zelensky in that sort of way. And it looks as if the attempt to provoke mass resignations by top military people within the military has failed. But that an attempt of some kind, along the lines of what Radovka was saying, does indeed seem to have taken place. one senior military official from Ukraine's Air Force did resign, backing Fyodorov against Sirski. And Bezuglaya, the dissident Ukrainian MP, has now published a statement on X in which she apparently says that the military have given instructions that no military officer or member of the Ukrainian military is permitted to post any comment on any social media platform whatsoever without first gaining the permission of the Ukrainian General Staff and the leadership of the Ukrainian military. Now, I have to say I'm a little surprised that these people have ever had permission to publish things on social media. I'd assume that in a wartime situation, the military would be imposing very tough controls of what officers in the serving Ukrainian army do publish. But, well, Bezuglaya tends to be reliable about these things. And I suspect what has happened is that the leadership of the Ukrainian military is now making absolutely clear to all senior serving army officers that any attempt to make any public expression of dissent known is going to provoke a very severe reaction from the top bodies of the Ukrainian armed forces. And that sort of thing only happens when there is serious worry about dissension within public dissension within the armed forces. Now, I don't myself think that, as I said, this dissension can amount to anything like a coup or anything like that. I understand that the nationalist units, the two Azov brigades, for example, in this argument between Sirski and Fyodorov, are publicly and strongly backing Sirski. And I understand also that this is true of Ukrainian military intelligence and of the special forces, and also, of course, of Ukraine's internal intelligence agency, the SBU, whose acting chief, Yevgeny Khana, is now also acting defense minister until he's formally appointed to that position. In the meantime, however, other things have also been happening which suggest that the Zelensky government is now taking steps to concentrate, to tighten control in light of the response to Fyodorov's sacking. So Klimenko, the police official who is Zelensky's first choice for defense minister, but who ran into opposition from MPs within Zelensky's party. Anyway, Zelensky is apparently proposing that Klimenko be appointed secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council, in which case, of course, he will be replacing Zelensky's long-term political ally, Rustem Umerov, who, of course, continues to serve as secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council, and who has also at times acted as chief negotiator in the various negotiations which took place last year and in January involving the Americans and the Russians. So Klimenko is apparently going to be brought into the centre of power in Kiev. In some respects, the National Defence and Security Council in Ukraine is an even more influential body than the Ukrainian military, than the Ukrainian Defence Ministry itself is, just say. And, well, alongside those changes, there have also been reports that over the last few hours, Sirski, the military chief involved in this power struggle with Fyodorov, that he has had some kind of private meeting with Andrei Yermak, Zelensky's former chief of staff, who, of course, was pushed out following the Golden Toilets scandal, and who has been replaced as chief of staff by the current chief of staff, Kirill Budanov, but who is still widely believed to be calling the strings and to be the second most powerful person in Ukraine after Zelensky himself. So all of this reshuffling, all of these various moves, suggests that there is something in the Radovka story after all, and that enough was taking place to make Zelensky and other senior Ukrainian officials nervous and to cause them to act in order to lock down the political system and to make sure that Fyodorov himself was pushed out into the cold. So, we are probably going to see now the conclusion of this crisis in Kiev. It does, as I said, seem to have been in some respects a more serious crisis than first appeared, but it does seem to me that Zelensky and Sirski and Yermak and all of the others remain firmly in control, wielding the levers of power. If there'd been strong opposition to Fyodorov's sacking from the heads of European governments, it might have been a different story. But European governments have remained mostly silent about what has just happened in Kiev, and one does get the sense that Fyodorov has just basically been cut loose. In a programme that Alex Christoforou and I made on the Duran, we discussed how this whole drone offensive operation, which Fyodorov is credited with fathering, with only partial truth, by the way, has now developed into a very, very big business indeed, involving lots of very powerful players, and that it makes sense, therefore, to push him aside, and so that other bigger players can take his place. The fact that European governments have basically remained silent following Fyodorov's dismissal sort of confirms this. And without the public backing of European governments, it's difficult to see how a serious attempt by someone like Fyodorov to challenge the political system, to challenge Zelensky's and Yermak's and Sirski's leadership of the country, how that challenge could possibly succeed. So, anyway, there we are. Now, all of this perhaps tends to draw attention away from what were the proximate causes of Fyodorov's dismissal. If Fyodorov had really been as successful as defense minister as some of the commentaries in the West are saying, if he'd really been the genius that the Financial Times said he was, then it's difficult to see how he could have been sacked. The Western governments would have insisted that he must remain in place. The reality is otherwise, and I think the position has been set out most succinctly by Scott Ritter in a post on X. The removal of Fyodorov as defense minister underscores the dilemma which confronts Ukraine heading into the second half of the summer. Fyodorov sold Zelensky on the ability of drones and AI to change the strategic momentum of the conflict away from Russia. Tremendous resources were poured into this campaign. Today, the drone campaign has failed to accomplish its goals. Fyodorov wanted to double down on failure and pour more resources into the drone campaign. Sirski is trying to manage a collapsing front. He needs manpower and equipment to hold the line. Fyodorov's drone campaign has denied him resources, and he appealed to Zelensky to allocate the resources necessary to give him a fighting chance. Fyodorov objected, believing Ukraine needed to rely on more drone attacks. Sirski won, and Fyodorov is out. Expect Ukraine to continue failing on both fronts, the drone campaign and on the front line. And that was written by Scott Ritter. Now, I don't always agree with Scott Ritter's assessments about what is actually taking place in the war, but on this occasion, I absolutely do. I think that describes exactly and precisely what has been happening. The drone campaign has been attracting a massive amount of attention. It spawned a narrative in the West about Ukraine wresting the initiative back from Russia. But in reality and in fact, it has been failing. And as a good example, we can look at what happened with the big drone attack that the Ukrainians carried out on Russia again last night. Something close to 400 drones were again used. And a large number of these drones were launched again towards the Black Sea and towards the Sea of Azov. It is no longer the case, it is not the case, that the Ukrainians are not launching drones to attack shipping on the street, on the Sea of Azov. I read a report in TASS which makes it clear that the Ukrainians do indeed continue to launch drones to attack ships in the Sea of Azov. But we are no longer getting video footage of ships being attacked on the Sea of Azov. They attacked the Sea of Azov again last night, but it seems that they struck and hit nothing, which leads me to think that the Russians have indeed been successful in developing air defences to protect shipping in the Sea of Azov. Last night, the Ukrainians also presumably launched drone attacks on ships in the Black Sea. But again, I saw no evidence at all of any ships being hit by drones in the Black Sea. What the Ukrainians did do is that they did also launch drone strikes on Russia itself, on the Moscow region, but the targets were very interesting. They don't seem to have made an attempt to attack Moscow itself. They attacked some kind of oil or petrol storage facility in a town called Noginsk, and a drone, or the Russians like to say drone fragments, but let's assume it was a drone, did hit this facility, and there's pictures of a fire and a smoke column, but the smoke column, from what I can see, is rather small, which suggests that the damage done to this facility was not particularly great. But the Ukrainians also struck two other targets. One was in a town called Tambov, where a warehouse owned by a Russian company called Wildberries was located. There was an attempt to hit this warehouse. Some damage was done. Some civilians were killed. The Russians are saying up to 9 civilians were killed. And an attack was also carried out on another Wildberries warehouse in a different place in Russia, Elektrostal, which is another suburb of Moscow, another town in the Moscow region. And apparently this much bigger warehouse was badly damaged and essentially destroyed. But the point is that it too apparently belonged to Wildberries. Now, outside Russia, Wildberries is virtually unknown. But to explain what Wildberries is, it is the Russian equivalent of Amazon. In fact, there are two giant e-commerce companies in Russia. One is Wildberries, the other is Ozone. They both work very efficiently, and they have now a complete coverage of Russia. Like Amazon, they have big warehouses where they store goods that they then have to distribute. And, well, as far as I'm aware, both Wildberries and Ozone are entirely civilian companies. I don't believe that they are involved in the special military operation at all, and I can't imagine that they are involved in providing logistics for the Russian military. If you know anything at all about the way that Wildberries and Ozone work, you would know that this really just doesn't make any kind of sense. And the Russian military, anyway, has its own logistics system. So it seems to me that what the Ukrainians were trying to do last night was to attack what they would call logistic facilities, but of a purely civilian nature, intended to disrupt the supply of goods to Moscow, where obviously e-commerce has developed to enormous levels, and also to give the impression that their drones are indeed hitting targets on logistic facilities. Now, the point is that if the Ukrainians are reduced to attacking these kind of essentially civilian targets, in fact, entirely civilian targets, causing death, according to the Russians, to 9 civilians, then that strongly suggests to me that the drone offensive is indeed failing, that it is failing in its attempts to hit Russian military industrial facilities, military logistics centers, and that the ability to continue to conduct attacks on refineries is ebbing as well. The Ukrainians still need to show that their drones are hitting something. So they're going after soft targets like Wild Berries warehouses. Well, that's my view. Obviously, some people are going to try to argue against this, and they're going to try to claim that the Wild Berries warehouses are indeed part of Russia's military logistics chain, and that Wild Berries actually has some role in the special military operation, some key role in the special military operation. I believe, I know otherwise, but if people want to argue that case, well, of course, they're welcome to do so. Anyway, there it is. The Ukrainians going through some kind of a political crisis in Kiev, wanting still to show that the drone offensive is having some effects, attacking what are clearly now entirely civilian facilities. Meanwhile, the ground war itself goes on, and we've had confirmation now that the Russians, whilst continuing to conduct massive strikes against Odessa and its various ports, have extended their attacks to another port, another Ukrainian port, a very interesting location, in fact, which is the town and port complex of Nikolaev, which is located some distance from Odessa, east of Odessa, in fact, also on a river estuary. And this port facility, to my knowledge, has been attacked and heavily attacked by the Russians for the first time since the start of the special military operation. Now, Nikolaev is an interesting city because it was not just a port, though obviously not a port of the size and sophistication and complexity of Odessa itself, but it used to be a very important shipyard centre during the period both of the Russian Empire and of the Soviet Union. It was where Russian battleships and destroyers and then eventually Soviet aircraft carriers used to be built. And, well, after the Soviet Union collapsed, all of these industrial facilities gradually lost their capabilities, and I understand that the city and its port and industrial facilities are now shadows of what they used to be. Nikolaev was also, for a very brief moment, an apparent target of the Russian ground forces at the very start of the special military operation. After the Russian military captured the city of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper in the first days of the special military operation, a force made up mostly of paratroopers advanced northwest towards Nikolaev itself and came very close to its immediate environs. However, there were insufficient numbers within this force to capture Nikolaev itself. The Ukrainians rushed reinforcements to defend Nikolaev, and the Russians pulled back. So, an interesting place, and it's, as I said, played a small but interesting role in the special military operation. Well, the Russians are now back, not on the ground, but in the sky. They're bombing Nikolaev, and they're destroying the port there, and they continue to destroy the facility in Odessa. And there was a long article about the situation in Odessa, saying that ship owners are no longer willing to send ships there, and that the ports are effectively blockaded. And as I discussed at great length in my program yesterday, the entire port infrastructure once operated by Ukraine on the Black Sea has essentially now come to a stop. Now, the Russian journalist Marat Khairulin has provided a very interesting discussion of the overall situation on the battlefronts in Ukraine. He said that over the last week, there have not been any reports of towns or cities or villages being captured. Except I would add for that one brief report that the Russian Ministry of Defense published from a Russian military officer who is in Liman, who said that Liman has indeed been cleared and that the territory, as he put it, is securely under Russian control. The Russian Defense Ministry has not, however, followed that up with a specific report confirming the capture of Liman. And it is interesting to speculate why that is. Why they've told us indirectly that Liman has been captured, but why they haven't so far confirmed the fact in a specific report. Well, I think Khairulin provides part of the reason. And this is what he says. The past week, compared to previous ones, has not been marked by a large number of liberated or captured settlements. The troops are clearing liberated areas, terrain within their zone of responsibility, saturating them with holding units, conducting rotations, and creating a network of dispersed ammunition and logistics storage facilities. All this activity is necessary before conducting operations to seize large enemy defence areas. The lull is very deceptive. In fact, on most operational directions and sectors, significant changes are occurring, the analysis of which allows us for assumptions about preparations for broad operational strategic actions by the Russian armed forces. First, there is methodical daily combat work underway to destroy the fuel, energy and industrial structure of the Ukrainian armed forces in the operational and strategic depth of Ukrainian territory. And then comes a very interesting passage. The ports of Odessa and Odessa region, through which the main flow of resource support for the Ukrainian armed forces passes, have been practically blockaded. Ukrainian tankers and dry cargo ships are being destroyed at sea. In the operational depth of the Ukrainian defence, fuel and lubricant storage facilities and refueling points are being destroyed. Fire strikes are being delivered against the transport network. Railway equipment on the railways is being put out of action. Reconnaissance, detection and destruction of command posts and drone control points of the Ukrainian military is ongoing. Secondly, fragmentary information, and then he says this is normal, hints at a regrouping of the Russian army on practically all fronts. And thirdly, The past week has been characterized by the advance of the Russian army over large areas of the theater of operations. Salients in the line of contact have been cut off. These are isolated areas of Ukrainian troops. Areas of terrain between settlements are being brought under control. Bridgeheads and distributed starting areas are being prepared. This is aimed at ensuring the rapid and inconspicuous exit of Russian units from these areas to their starting lines for simultaneous coordinated actions in accordance with the command's plan. And, well, he then goes into much more detail about what is going on in particular parts of the front lines, which I am going to skip. But what he is saying here is that the Russians are now preparing for the next stage of their offensive. And it's not difficult to guess what that means. The capture of Orekhov in Zaporozhye region, the capture of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk in Donbass, or at least the forcing of an entry into Kramatorsk, which is expected fairly soon, further operations close to Dobropilia and perhaps in northeastern Ukraine. But note also the way that he says that all of the various things that we've been seeing, the destruction of the gas filling stations in eastern Ukraine and the attacks on the ports of Odessa and of the Odessa region are all integrated into this plan. Now, this is something I have been saying for a very, very long time. The Russians like to give the impression that these attacks that they make on industrial facilities in Kiev, on ships in Odessa, this imposition of the blockade on Odessa, the attacks on the ports, that these are reprisal operations for Ukrainian attacks on similar Russian facilities inside Russia. In reality, what they are operations that are integrated into the General Staff's plan, which is clearly intended, the Russia General Staff's plan, which is clearly intended to support the big further push on the contact line that is going to come in the second half of the summer. The Russians have now captured Konstantinovka and Liman. They have reached the very edge of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. There continue to be reports that there's fighting going on in Druzhivka. They have effectively surrounded Orekhov. And in the north, they have essentially reached Sumy, the city of Sumy, and partially surrounded it. And they appear to be closing in on Kharkiv as well. So they have advanced, they've captured Ukrainian positions, and they're preparing now for the next attack, and the attack on the gas filling stations and on the drone control points and on the ports of Odessa and Nikolaev and other places are intended to disrupt Ukrainian logistics in advance of those operations, that big blow which is about to come. And when I say about to come, I am guessing that we're going to start to see a renewed momentum, a renewed push towards Kramatorsk itself over the next couple of days, as soon as that. Now, Radovka, also published its own report about the fighting last night. It said that the Russians have now come very close to some kind of airfield complex, which is located immediately to the east of Kramatorsk. I didn't even know this airfield existed, and I don't know what its military significance, if any, is. But the Russians are continuing to push towards Kramatorsk. The Russian Defense Ministry also had a report from a Russian soldier. This is on the Defense Ministry's Telegram channel, saying that he was talking about how his unit is moving closer and closer to Slavyansk, at the other end of the Kramatorsk. Slavyansk line of fortified cities. And Denis Pushilin, the head of the Russian-backed Donetsk regional government, is saying that the Russians are now pushing all across the conflict line and that the battle for Slavyansk and Kramatorsk is indeed about to begin, though he anticipates that the battle for Slavyansk is going to be very hard. Now, Redovka perhaps also provided an explanation for why the Russians have not yet announced the capture of Lima, because Redovka said that the Russians do not want the Ukrainians to concentrate all their forces to defend at this time the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. So they're trying to keep, to keep some Ukrainian forces still in the Liman area, and they specifically mention Liman, not in the city, not in the town itself. And apparently this is so as to deter the Ukrainians from concentrating their defenders in one place at this time. Well, that is Redovka. I can't speak for the truth of that. I am not myself there, as I have repeatedly pointed out in many programs. It may be that this is right, or maybe not. But anyway, that is what Redovka is saying. So anyway, we will see how this plays out over the next couple of days. But I have found Khairulin, who is extremely well-informed and obviously extremely well-connected. I have consistently found Khairulin to be the most accurate of all reporters of the situation on the front lines. And in a program I made some months ago, I pointed out that Khairulin, back in the spring of 2025, gave his prediction of how the Russian summer offensive of 2025 would play out, and it played out exactly as he said it would, which I can only explain by Khairulin being provided with information by people from people within the Russian general staff with whom he is clearly in some sort of contact with. So anyway, that, it seems to me, is the situation at the moment. Now, the Russians have been saying some more things, and here we turn again to what they've been saying about the diplomacy of the war. They have become increasingly scathing about the diplomacy, and no Russian has been speaking in a scathing way more than the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. Now, Yesterday, Lavrov attended a press conference with the foreign minister of Azerbaijan, who is in Moscow on a fence mending visit. And over the course of this press conference, Lavrov inevitably was asked questions about the state of diplomacy with respect to Ukraine. And he said some very interesting things. He said that the Russians have in the past always sought to end the conflict through negotiations. They supported negotiations. They've always supported negotiations and always supported whatever agreements the Ukrainian authorities, from whichever side they have come from, have made with the Ukrainian opposition. This was true, as he said, in 2014, twice in 2014, and once in 2015. And it was also true in negotiations which took place in Paris in 2019, which Zelensky himself attended. In each case, the Ukrainians, backed by the West, went back on every agreement that they had signed. And then Lavrov said that as for the recent meeting in Anchorage, he suggested that the media check out what President Trump said at the news conference directly after the meeting in Alaska, and what President Trump said about the meeting in Alaska in the days after the meeting took place. And on every occasion, President Trump confirmed that there had been a meeting in Alaska, had been an agreement reached in Alaska, and that the agreement that was reached in Alaska was based on his, that is to say, Trump's proposals. And then Lavrov became extremely scathing. He referred to an article that has just appeared in the Washington Times. The article says that the United States, the Trump administration, has offered Russia sanctions relief and economic cooperation if it reaches an agreement with the United States on the topic of Ukraine. And Lavrov was visibly angry. He said, in effect, we did reach an agreement with the Americans in Ukraine, over Ukraine. We did that in Anchorage. It is the Americans, not us, who are in effect going back on what they agreed with us in Anchorage. Lavrov, obeying Putin's instructions, did not directly criticize Trump, but bear in mind that he reminded the media of what Trump himself said at the joint news conference with Putin and what he said in the days immediately following the summit meeting in Alaska. He said that if there's no economic cooperation between Russia and the United States, it's not because the Russians have not been able or willing to reach agreements with the Americans. It is because the Americans have gone behind the agreements, have gone back on the agreements they made with Russia. And then Lavrov got even more angry because he said that the United States at the present time is distracted by the situation in the Middle East, that this is causing tension in Kiev because the Ukrainians are frustrated that because the United States is bogged down in the Middle East, it is not joining the Europeans in redoubling and trebling and quadrupling the pressure on Russia. And Lavrov then said that there's again rumours that Witkoff and Kushner might be coming to Moscow. But Lavrov referred to Witkoff and Kushner as America's do-it-all negotiators. Let the American do-it-all negotiators, Witkoff and the son-in-law of the US president, do what their president tells them, whilst we take care of our own business. President Putin has clearly said what this business is. We started after the failure of all attempts to resolve the Ukrainian situation peacefully, when all signatories of all previous documents lied and then admitted that they did not want to do anything. That was when we started on our business. This work will be done. So what Lavrov here is saying is that he doesn't think much of Witkoff and Kushner. He regards them as ineffectual busybodies and non-entities, and he doesn't really feel that they have any further place in negotiations. He doesn't exactly say that, but he makes the thrust of this fairly clear. And he says that we're not renegotiating that which we already negotiated. We accepted an American proposal in Anchorage. If the Americans can't act on it, so be it. We will continue with our own business. In other words, we will fight on and we will win the war. Now that, it seems to me, is perfectly clear. It's absolutely obviously what Lavrov was saying. So it seems to me that after listening to what Lavrov is saying, there can no longer be any serious doubt that the Russians have, to all intents and purposes, lost all further interest in negotiations with the Americans. The Russians no longer believe that negotiations with Trump, with the Americans, are possible. They don't believe that the Europeans have any plans for negotiations. In fact, a Russian official has actually written about this. He says that the only plan that the Europeans have is to continue the war indefinitely. And this Russian official, foreign ministry official, said that the interesting thing about the $70 billion aid package to Ukraine, which was agreed at the NATO summit meeting in Ankara, is that this package, this aid package, is now supposed to be a recurring package that is going to continue every year that the war goes on for. In other words, that the Europeans are going to be giving Zelensky every year 70 billion euros as a kind of bribe to continue the war. It's unsurprising, given that that is what the Russians are thinking at this time, that the Russians are now fed up with the whole business of negotiations. And for the record, I don't think that President Putin is any different. There's been a lot of speculation about why President Putin doesn't directly criticize Donald Trump. I don't think it is because Putin or anyone else in the Russian leadership seriously expects anymore any kind of negotiated resolution of the Ukraine conflict. It's just that the Russians want to keep some kind of dialogue with the Americans going so that when the war is over and when it is won, there is something for them and the Americans, there is some mechanism so that then the Americans and the Russians can talk with each other in order to come to some post-war understanding that will limit the otherwise catastrophic damage that will have been done to the overall situation, the political and military situation in Europe. So I've scarcely ever read comments of Lavrov's in which he comes across quite as angry and as disrespectful of American envoys as he did in these comments. I would add that there was a time last year, in the first half of last year, when the Russians, Putin and Lavrov and the others, were rather taken by Steve Witkoff, and they expressed concern about reports in the United States that there were moves in the United States to remove him, from his position as negotiator with the Russians. Well, that was a year ago. Today, Lavrov talks about Witkoff and also Kushner in entirely different terms. The damage that has been done to mutual trust between the Russians and the Americans by the effective failure of the summit meeting in Anchorage is something that cannot be overstated. And, well, it surprises me that very few people in the West pick up on it. Anyway, that was Lavrov. That's what I'm going to say about the situation in Ukraine today. Now, even as Lavrov was talking about Kushner and Witkoff and using this scathing language about them, I've read reports that during the negotiations between the Americans and the Iranians tipped off the chief American negotiator, J.D. Vance, about Witkoff and Kushner. Allegedly, and I do want to stress this, allegedly, they told Vance that Witkoff and Kushner could not be trusted and that they were pursuing different interests from those that Vance had as chief of the negotiating team. Now, I can't fully confirm this report, which has appeared on independent media, but I believe it to be true for all kinds of reasons. And it shows that Witkoff and Kushner are mistrusted, not just by the Russians, but by others as well, specifically the Iranians. Now, the Iranians apparently have now come round to the conclusion that the United States does indeed plan some kind of ground operation against Iran. And the speculation is that the form this ground operation is going to take is an attempt to capture some of the islands in the Persian Gulf and in the Strait of Hormuz, first and foremost Harg Island, which of course President Trump has been talking about for a very, very long time. I mean, he apparently first discussed seizing Harg Island all the way back in the 1980s, long before he became involved in US politics, just saying. Anyway, there it is. So we're back to a ground operation, or at least talk of a ground operation, though President Trump himself apparently expects this ground operation not to be conducted by the American military, but by some other military instead. He doesn't tell us which. Presumably, he realizes how massively unpopular and controversial a ground operation involving American soldiers would be, and that's why he is saying what he is saying. Now, I don't have any other military that has the capability or the desire to take on the Iranians to capture Harg Island or any other island that currently belongs to Iran. The Persian Gulf states, taken together, have, in terms of size, substantial armed forces. But I doubt they would be interested in this sort of operation, which would be incredibly difficult for them. The Israelis, I suspect it's the same. I can't imagine that Turkey would want to become involved. So when an American president says that he wants to see this kind of operation carried out, but not by American ground troops, I can't help but think that eventually, at the back of his mind, he does intend to deploy American ground troops. After all, that was the line that President Johnson took in the run-up to the US intervention in Vietnam in the 1960s. As many of us remember, he appeared to rule out the deployment of American ground troops. He said that he could see no reason why American boys should be doing that which it was the job of Asian boys to do. I've not quoted him exactly, but that's fairly close to what he said. But anyway, it looks as if, it seems to me, that when Trump talks about some kind of a ground operation and talks airily about other armies than the American doing it, it is the American military that he has in mind, and that he's engaging in the same kind of obfuscation that President Johnson did all those long decades ago. Now, if this is the operation that President Trump is thinking about, then I would repeat what Professor Mearsheimer has said. It's a one-way suicide mission. What Jim Webb has also said, that it's practically unachievable. What Joe Kent, who used to serve Donald Trump in his administration, and he was a special forces officer, has also said, that sending American troops to capture Harg Island would be a trap for them. And the same applies to all the various other islands that have been talked about in the Strait of Hormuz. To me, it looks like some kind of a debacle again in preparation. It's an incredibly bad idea. But, well, the president has failed to take the diplomatic route which the MOU offered him. At some point, there will be problems in global energy markets. The inventories of weapons would become run down, and the reserves of oil and petroleum products will run down too. He cannot, it seems to me, simply return to the MOU. The Iranians themselves are ruling it out, and the failure of the MOU has now caused so much mistrust on both sides towards each other that negotiations are all but impossible. There is, in theory, an option, which is that the United States just quietly walks away without any kind of agreement at all and leaves it to the Persian Gulf states and the Iranians to sort out with each other. What happens with the Strait of Hormuz? If I was advising President Trump, that is the course I would advise him to follow. Just leave it to the Iranians and the Persian Gulf states to work it out between them. But it looks very unlikely that that is indeed what he is going to do. So logically, since he can't leave the situation unresolved, or at least he believes he can't leave the situation unresolved, and as the clock is ticking down, he is going to go for the kind of ground operation that I've just been discussing. If so, this is going to be a massive debacle. The Iranians, moreover, are now saying very worrying, very alarming things. If there is a ground operation, the Houthis will indeed, at that point, close the Red Sea. They haven't yet done it, but they are ready to do it. They're primed to do it. The reason they haven't done it, apparently, is because the Iranians have told them not to do it, because the Iranians want to keep the Red Sea open as it provides them with a potential threat and leverage over the Americans. And the Iranians are also saying that if there is a ground operation, it will be all-out war between Iran and the United States and its various allies. And those allies include the Persian Gulf states, and at least some Iranians are saying that at the conclusion of this war, the Persian Gulf states, the governments of these states, the various emirs and kings who rule over these states, that they will have been swept away. Now, I am not predicting that all of these things will happen. I don't know what Iranian capabilities actually are. I don't know whether, if the Americans suffer a debacle in the Persian Gulf, the Iranians really would advance across the Persian Gulf into the Arabian Peninsula. I would have thought there would be enormous dangers and risks in doing that. And of course, the other big Sunni military powers, Turkey, Egypt, and above all Pakistan, which has a defence agreement with Saudi Arabia, almost certainly would intervene. But, well, there are other things short of an outright invasion of the Arabian Peninsula that the Iranians could do. Attacks on the desalination plants that provide essential water for the great cities of the Arabian Peninsula, and I believe for Israel itself, would be one option. So, a very, very dangerous game is now being played in the Middle East. I really do wonder who exactly is advising the president and why he seems to have this genius for following the wrong advice. I would have thought that by now it ought to be obvious to him that getting deeper involved in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East altogether is disastrous for the United States and for him personally. There are reports that already he and Prime Minister Netanyahu are barely on speaking terms because of the recriminations which pass between them. Again, I'd be very, very careful by taking those reports seriously. We've been misled many times about supposed quarrels between Netanyahu and Trump. But anyway, up to now, whenever President Trump has been offered the choice over the conflict with the Middle East, he has consistently chosen the wrong one. We will see whether those who argue for restraint finally prevail with him. But given that they have consistently failed to do so up to now, well, I do generally wonder and fear where all this is going. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.